To read Back to Reality, the best-selling novel of the Bestseller Experiment by the two Marks, go to bestsellerexperiment.com/back to reality.
And subscribe to this podcast to get loads of extra bonuses. Go to bestsellerexperiment.com/subscribe. Let's run the show.
Hello and welcome to the Bestseller Experiment, where we continue to discover what makes a best-selling novel and inspire you to finish your book. I'm Mark Stay.
And I'm Mark DeVoe. And before we dive into this episode, we'd like to say thank you to everyone who is supporting us as a patron for this show. You are the sponsor of the show. You make this show happen. And if you're not a patron, please do check out all of the benefits you get for being a patron. One of which is very important, is you get the full exclusive interview with today's incredible author, plus the post chat that Mark and I do, where we really delve deep into all of the ins and outs. There are so many other benefits. I really would love for you to go to bestsellerexperiment.com/support to find out what else you will get for just putting a few of your kind pennies towards the show each month. So Mark, if you were to say you had to choose between two packets of hobnobs and a new patron, what would you have to pick? I mean, it's a hard one, isn't it? But
see, I'm trying to lose weight, whereas patron is enriching. Let me put it like this. We had a note from one of our most recent patrons, Rick West. He said, "Hi there, I'm a newbie. Just heard my first deep dive." Now, listeners, the deep dives are the extra episodes that we do for our Patreon supporters. They're exclusive to them. You'll hear a little teaser for it later in the show. "This stuff is gold dust," says Rick. "I feel the Marks have created a wonderful community of writers here. Thank you very much. Glad to be a part of it, Rick." Well, Rick, welcome to the gang. Welcome also to Darius Matthew and Shannon McEwen, our latest two patron supporters. You're all wonderful. And we do have a wonderful community. Particularly, we have an exclusive BXP group on Facebook where folks are exchanging ideas all the time. And we'll talk some more about that at the end of the show with our social media slot. They've been very, very active recently.
There's so much going on there. So get over to bestsellerexperiment.
Get to experiment.com.
It's Norwegian chef coming out of me there.
The Swedish chef.
So come on.
It's an outtake.
We'll just leave it in if you like that. So get over to bestsellerexperiment.com/support. And honestly, once you hear what you're missing, you will realize just how valuable this is. There is never enough information we can get on improving ourselves as authors, and we'd like you to delve deep with us. So Mark, I think this is one of the most interesting interviews we've ever done. I've got to say, this interview coming up later as a little teaser, I was absolutely riveted. Riveted.
Yes, Tade Thompson. We'll talk about him a bit more later on. I've been trying to get him on the show for a while. He's an amazing author, such a smart guy. His book, his latest books, Rosewater and Rosewater Insurrection, are the finest science fiction, and I absolutely love them. It's mind-blowing stuff, and it just astonishes me how he gets this stuff on the page and makes it so readable. But more of that later.
More of that later, absolutely. Now, talking of interesting things that have been going on recently, you had another festival. This is like, you seem to be like this rock star of authors right now. You seem to be going every single which way. But you're not just doing the Glastonbury's, you're also doing the locals as well. Tell us about the one you went to recently.
It was Witlit, which is the Whitstable Literary Festival, which has been going for about 5 years now.
Wow.
And they've had some really big names, Linda LaPlante was there. The guy who did the Villanelle books, God, I've forgotten his name. That's embarrassing. But that people will know it as Killing Eve on TV. He wrote those, wow, which was amazing. Nice. All sorts of really top authors, including some people we've had on the show, not least Julie Wasmer and John McGee and Catherine May. We had them first, folks, just want to say. And Claire, she did a wonderful children's event. She does these wonderful children's gardening events for her Lottie and Dottie children's books, where kids come along and they plant sunflower seeds and they talk about what they're growing, and she reads them a story, and then they get to take the seeds home and grow their own sunflowers, which is
brilliant.
Wonderful. Yeah, and I did a an interview with Anstey Harris, who's an author from Canterbury, who has some wonderful new book out. That was really good fun interviewing her. And I got to see Susie Dent as well. Now, if in the UK, Susie Dent is a bit of a national treasure. She's on a TV show here called Countdown, which, if you love words and numbers, is a national institution. It was the first ever show shown on Channel 4, and it's one of the longest running panel show sort of quiz shows that we have in the UK. And she also does a show called 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown, which is like the adult R-rated version of it. And I'm sitting here listening to Susie, because Susie Dent is great. She talks about words. She loves words and usage, and I love her stuff, and I love her books. And I'm surrounded by all these old dears, and they bring up 8 out of 10 cats, and you can hear them all going, "Oh, that sounds interesting." I'm just thinking, as soon as they tune in, it's absolute filth. Jimmy Carr
does that as well, doesn't he? In fact, you know, out in Netflix in the US now and Canada, Jimmy Carr has got like a Netflix show which is utter filth and very, very funny. I'm a big fan of his, having seen him a lot in the UK. But if you haven't, if you've seen that video on Netflix, imagine, it's not quite, his live shows are off the charts. I mean, but if you imagine that slightly toned down, but still very rude, that's probably 8 out of 10 cats does Countdown. But
yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant. What? I love this. I tell you what, festivals, the word eclectic comes to mind. It's just such an incredible thing. What would you say to people, Mark, authors who have never been to a book festival? Because they're not everywhere. I mean, if somebody hasn't been, what would you say would be the main reason for going to one?
You find your local community of writers. If you've got one on your doorstep or nearby to you, definitely go to it, because you'll meet people. Volunteer. I'll tell you what, they're always desperate for volunteers who can help out. Then you get to know how it's run, what sort of events work, what sort of events are less successful. You get to know your local bookshop. So, yeah, get involved. There are bigger ones. There are really big ones, which, you know, you can pay quite a lot of money to go to, and things like the Hay Festival and stuff like that, where, you know, you go for a weekend, you book a hotel, that sort of thing. But to be honest, there's something about Kent. Since I've moved to Kent, I guess it's because Surrey was right on London's doorstep. We didn't have much like this. Epsom only had an arts festival the year I left, typically.
Right.
Kent, there's just so many writers out here, and so many little festivals, and so many wonderful little independent bookshops. It really does feel like I've come home. Mm. It's an amazing community.
And here's a tip to everyone who hasn't got a festival close to them. Start one.
Start one.
If you've got a writing group, chuck the idea out in the writing group. Say, you know what, we don't have a festival. That's the only reason they exist, is because somebody once said, you know what, we should have a book festival. So, you know, yeah. And if it's your festival that you're organising, what an incredible way to get your own name known within the local writing community. And, you know, there's a lot of proactive things we can do. I know that writing takes up a lot of time, but I think the socialisation of writers is something that's really, really not misunderstood, but undervalued by writers. I think it's such a lonely business when you're stuck away in your little writing desk or on your laptop, wherever you might be, that since I joined my writing group, you find these like-minded people that might be writing all different kinds of genres, but the things that you learn together, I mean, what the Tolkien film just came out recently, and he was part of an incredible writing group, C.S. Lewis, and who was the other chap?
Yes, I can't remember.
There were three of them.
Inkers.
But it's.
I'm going to have to look this up now. Hang on.
Go on. You look it up whilst I talk.
Keep talking.
Talking for time. But you know, you take that example of authors who had incredible success. But I found in our writing group, the success of one author spurs other authors. And it's very rare to find just one successful author in a writing group. There's usually 2, 3, 4, and it keeps growing. The ones that are successful then want to put back into the group because it was the group. Like Shannon Mayer says this very openly. And Shannon, we've interviewed a number of times, and she's going to be coming back on the show very soon as well. But she owes a lot to our writing group because she started there as someone who'd never sold a book. And now she's sold over a couple of million copies. So, I mean, there's a testament in itself.
Absolutely. It's the Inklings. And right. Amongst its members were Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, G.K. Chesterton. I love Chesterton. George MacDonald. So, yeah, it's Rick. Funnily enough, Rick, who we mentioned at the beginning of the show with his note to us on Patreon, Rick runs a writer's group in Whitstable. I was invited along to speak a couple of weeks ago and told them all about the podcast and my writing and stuff like that. But, you know, he's got this burgeoning group of writers over there. And it's great that someone like Rick hosts it in his house. You know, we all get a cup of tea and biscuits and what have you. And we chat about writing. And I'm making friends in the local community as a result. Mm. So without people like Rick, that's not... You know, you're not talking about a giant festival with gazebos in a field somewhere or whatever. This is you know, someone like, with the generosity of spirit of someone like Rick, who's inviting people around, sharing ideas, and we all go away enriched.
Yeah, that's, I mean, what it's all about. In some ways, when you think about like a book reading club where you just get together with friends to read, you don't think of that as an incredibly challenging thing to set up. It's just asking a few friends, getting a rota going, picking a book, setting a deadline to read it by, and then getting some wine nibbles, which apparently is what goes on in a lot of book reading clubs. But a writing club doesn't have to be anything more complex than that. You don't have to, in our writing club, we don't have an agenda. It's like we show up, sometimes someone make a presentation, sometimes they won't. Just getting people sitting around talking about, you know, what happened this week, what their goals might be, the conversation starts. And honestly, the hardest thing is stopping. Because people just want to talk because they get so little chance to do it. So I really encourage people to do that. And, you know, the easiest way to start is set up a Facebook group and just call it the, you know, name of town or village, Writers Club, something like that, as basic as that. Mm. Or using something like Meetup. Meetup is a great site for creating a new group, and people will search and try and find like-minded individuals, and you can kind of build... you can build a community of writers, but most importantly, find two or three other people who share that passion for writing. That's all you need to start a club, and that could eventually grow to a festival. You just never know.
Excellent stuff. Excellent. Good idea.
What else has been happening in your world, Block, in this last week?
I've been really busy writing. I finished a 95-page screenplay in about 2 weeks.
That's crazy.
Interesting. Although I've got the notes back from John. Needs a lot of work.
Words you don't want to hear.
No, I don't. Well, that's first draft stuff. That's what it is, you know. So we outlined. It's what they call a vomit draft. So I just got it down, you know.
Pleasant.
And it's and it's there. And we got 95 pages a week, and we got lots of good stuff. And lots of stuff that needs work, but we have that. We didn't have that 2 weeks ago, so I'm really happy with that. I'm letting that rest for a while. John sent his notes back to me. I'm going to let those digest for another week or so. I also got notes back on my little first Woodville novella, which I'm now doing. I've been doing a little triage on how to fix that, so hopefully get that sorted in the next couple of weeks. So that's cool. I've started a writer's services page on my website as well. Mm. So, and I got my first paying customer today, which is brilliant.
Bugger me.
So I did a reader's report for someone, which was fantastic.
That's
so,
excellent.
You know, pop over to markstaywrites.com and find me there, and I'll do all sorts of stuff. So, fantastic. So I've been busy, man. I've been busy.
It's been a busy kind of world, isn't it, recently? There's lots and lots going on. I'm very excited as well. I've seen all these music themed movies coming out. You know, we were talking just the other week about how I was trying to force you to write a screenplay for the Pink Floyd biopic movie that has to be written. We were talking about Bohemian Rhapsody. I just saw a commercial for Rocket Man, which is coming out at the end of the month, which is Elton John's story. Yeah. It seems to be a bit of a theme. And considering our book, Back to Reality, is all about that stuff, I just see the world and the universe lining up for somebody to pick up that book, have a read of it, go, you know, this would make a really good film. Everyone keeps saying that. I keep seeing that cropping up on reviews time and time again. We keep getting these Amazon reviews. And one of the most common threads is this has to be made into a movie. So if you haven't read it yet, what do you think? Read the book just to tell us whether you think it should be made into a movie. And one day we're going to do a deep dive on, I think, a bit about how we wrote the book with a kind of movie vision in mind in terms of how it played out. And I think it's a very interesting strategy we use. We haven't really talked about it much on the show, have we? But I think it can be, for visual people, it can be a really good way of writing a book, which then also gives it the chance to potentially easily become a movie because it's already very visual in what we've written. So yeah, that's good stuff. And do we mention about that, it hasn't happened yet, but you've landed or secured an interesting placement that's coming up for Back to Reality soon. Can we mention that now, or should we leave that till later as a teaser?
Well, it's we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it because we've pitched and we got first time.
Hello.
A BookBub featured deal.
Why?
So by the time this podcast goes out, it would have happened.
Oh, excellent.
So we'll do a post-mortem maybe in the next episode to see how it went. It's an interesting one because, we've had all these ups and downs over what category it should be.
Yeah.
Now, of course, this is BookBub have made our mind up for us. They've said very firmly, humour. So they're pitching it as a humour title. It's going out on their humour newsletter. They predict, here's the weird thing. I was looking at the details. I don't think this is going out in the States. I think this is only Europe and South Africa, I think.
That's random.
So they predict we'll sell about 460 copies, roughly.
Mm. Yeah, give or take.
So this isn't a mega... it's just good, but I'm very up for 460 copy sale. That's fantastic. But yeah, let's see how that pans out. But yeah, pitch for it first time. I mean, you have to fill out a form. You have to sort of give them an idea of, strategy and what have you and pitch the book. So yeah, we're coming just in time.
Yeah,
frankly.
Well, absolutely. And we'll also, the other thing that you mentioned in a kind of private discussion we had was about, it's not just about the BookBub event. It's about what that can do to getting the book into a chart and how that we can then potentially continue to promote it to keep it sticky, or whether it will actually gain some of its own kind of flywheel effect. So we're really excited to see what happens. We've heard about a lot of authors who've talked about getting a BookBub deal. We know it's not easy to do, but we'll be reporting back as part of the crash test experiment to let you know how that goes. So stay tuned, folks, over the next couple of weeks to see what happens.
Exciting.
So Mark, let's get to our incredible interview that we have today. As I said before, I was absolutely riveted. This is one clever chappy.
he's fantastic. Tadae Thompson. I read his book, Rosewater, which is the first in a new series. He's written a number of books, but he's the author of Rosewater, which was a finalist in the John W. Campbell Awards, the Kitschies Golden Tentacle Award. He's also been nominated pretty much for every major science fiction award this year. I was at EasterCon. He was nominated there. I know he's been nominated for the big awards at the Hugo Awards later in the year at Worldcon. He's just a terrific author. Rosewater was also Audible's Science Fiction Audiobook of the Year. And I just wanted to, because reading the book, the novel is extraordinary. I mean, if you love science fiction, you really, really dig this. It's Rosewater is a town, and it's kind of host to a mysterious alien biodome, okay? And it's this weird art thing from another, another world. And it involves a guy called Caro, who's a government agent who has this kind of psychic connection to it. I don't want to say too much. We discuss it more in the interview. But so many of these ideas have the potential to be difficult and challenging and strange. But Tadae, he's so skillful. He makes it so readable. And as you'll discover in the interview, there's a very good reason for that. You'll listen to how diligent he is and some of the fantastic methods that he uses as proof of concept to make his ideas work.
Absolutely. And we'll be discussing that more after the interview as well. So listen now as Mark interviews Tadae.
Tadae Thompson, welcome to the Bestseller Experiment. How are you today, sir?
I'm fine. I'm loving the weather in this fine country of ours.
Yes, it's if you like the colour grey, you're going to be delighted, yeah. Aren't you?
Favorite colour.
Exactly. Now, I'm really excited to speak to you because your book, Rosewater, was one of my favourite books of last year, and certainly it's making all the best of 2018 roundups. It's Audible's Science Fiction Book of the Year. It won the inaugural Nomo Award for African Speculative and Science Fiction. And it has a really complex world and story. You've got the Xenosphere, you've got sensitives, you've got an alien dome, you've got zombies walking the streets, a temple made of meat. And at the center of this, you've got a protagonist, Caro, with a very murky past. He's a very unreliable narrator. I loved so much about the book is how you tease the reader with all of this stuff, just enough to keep them on the hook, the character, the world building, the history. This is one of the most complex or difficult things to master, I think, is keeping, particularly with science fiction, because there's so much going on here. How aware are you of that process as a writer of teasing and hooking people in?
All right. First of all, I'll say thank you very much for your kind words. I'm really grateful that it's been received the way it has been received. I feel humbled by it. As to how aware I am, I'm very much aware of it because, you know, at my heart, and I think at the heart of every science fiction writer, they're fans of the genre. Mm. And being a fan, I know the books that I like and the ones I don't like. I know the ones that drown me in technical detail and begin to bore me and make me skip pages. Mm. Now, one of the things, at least one of my driving maxims, I would say, is the need to write the kind of book that I would like to read. And I did not want to get bored. So whatever it is that I felt was boring to me, I left on the cutting floor, so to speak.
Right.
My feeling has always been, okay, I know what, you know, I've done the exercise of building the world and writing the history and the like, but the reader doesn't need all of that. What the reader needs is just enough to paint it, to start a picture in their mind, and then they can complete it. So I don't want to draw the entire picture. I want to tease the picture and let the reader go with what I've teased. Keeping the whole thing together was very important when I was growing up because, as you know, a lot of science fiction books come in trilogies. Mm. But whenever I went to a bookshop with my mom, it was myself and my older sister, and she would say, you can only have one book. And that meant that I had to make a choice between either buying the first, the second, or the third of a trilogy, or buy them over 3 months or something. So it became necessary. And I haven't even gone into the comics, because obviously the comics could either be single story or a three-part, four-part, so on part story. So I grew up with multiple narrative strands in my head, incomplete strands. In fact, there's some stories that I still don't know how they ended. In fact, there's a book called Masters of Solitude. I have only read the first two. I have not read the last volume. Oh, and gosh. I read that, I think, 20 years ago. And I still feel the incompleteness. You know, I'm still waiting to – I fit out a print. Anytime I go to a – you know that place on near Leicester Square on Charing Cross Road there? So there's a row of secondhand bookshops in London.
Yeah.
I keep scouring to see that one day maybe I will find it. You know, and I went underneath – Southwark Bridge. There's that massive place where there are secondhand books. I'm out for it. So all the trilogies that I never finished when I was younger, I still keep my eye out for them. So I got used to keeping multiple narrative strands in my head. I didn't know it would ever be useful, but apparently it is.
Now, I just want to dial back there because you said you were building the world and writing its history. Was that something you did before you started writing the novel proper, or is that something that evolved as you were working on drafts?
It evolves, but let me put it this way. If I get an idea, I usually just try it out in like either some flash fiction or a short story of about 5,000 words. Nice. So kind of like a proof of concept. So when I do that, the next thing I do is I say, okay, fine, what is this world? And so I write the first 5,000 words, which will have some characters, which may or may not make it into the final narrative. But it does kind of tell me, because they have to interact with the world, what will be necessary. So I then begin to extrapolate, okay, what do I need here? What needs to have happened for this to be here? And so on and so forth. So I begin to then tease out the world as will be necessary for any characters interacting with it. I'm helped in this because, you know, one of my qualifications is in social anthropology. So I know academically, I know what a society needs to have academically. I know what a culture needs to have. I know, you know, I know things about like currencies, like their customs around marriage, languages, you know, where do they live? How do they relate to elders? At what point are children considered human beings? All kinds of things like that, which is not, it's not actually the same in every society. I think in this society, for example, we take it for granted that a child is considered a human being, even though legally, at least in the UK, a child, you know, like it is at birth that a child becomes a legal entity. So 5 minutes before being born, that child doesn't exist legally yet.
Right.
Yeah, in the UK. You know, so it's not so odd. Like in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, you have to earn your humanity. So by being a child, you live listening to the elders. You're supposed to be seen and not heard. So you slowly acquire the qualities that make you a member of that society. You know, but before that, you're not necessarily, you're not part of decision making and the like. So it's interesting in that way. So I apply what I know in anthropology, and I apply everything else I know about world building and what should or shouldn't be, the who, when, where, why, what, all of that stuff. I answer all of those questions, and that's kind of how the world comes to be. It's very much for me about answering questions, and I'm a very curious person, but I'm also very skeptical. So if someone tells me something, then I have questions. So the questions I would have asked of anybody else, I ask them of myself.
Yeah.
You know, fantastic. And that's my approach.
That is absolutely fascinating. I just want to dial back to this idea of you essentially writing short fiction, 5,000 words or so, as proof of concept, which I think is such a wonderful idea, a way of just dipping your toe in. Does this mean that you've got a sort of a file somewhere full of concepts that didn't quite come into shape, that haven't quite worked yet, or maybe you need to go back to them and fix them? Are there lots of failed proofs of concept out there?
Do you mean for Rosewater specifically?
Well, for your writing generally, I just think it's a brilliant way to sort of try before you buy almost.
Yeah, well, generally, yes, there are. I have a lot of those. For Rosewater, I have at least 40,000 words of discarded material, discarded narrative. Not because I didn't feel it was good, but because it doesn't fit. It just doesn't. It doesn't fit the main narrative of Kara. It doesn't quite. It's good and it's pretty, but it's not useful. Therefore, it doesn't belong there. I kind of figured it was from the wrong point of view. So yes, the answer is yes. Lots of material does exist. Even the project I'm working on right now, the book that I'm working on right now, I already have about 10,000 words of narrative, which is not actually part of the book itself. It's just, does this work? Is this, you know, do I want to spend time in this world? Do I want to spend time with these characters? And, you know, once I'd done that, I said, okay, yes, I do. Then I then start the main narrative itself.
I love this idea that you've, because that takes an awful lot of discipline, you know, to be able to cut. I mean, every author listening to this, every writer listening to this is going to be thinking, oh, but I love that scene where so-and-so happens and that happens. But you're saying it wasn't Caro's story, so it had to go. I mean, is that something you've learned over time, or is it just something that you always instinctively knew?
Everything that I say today, I might as well state this now. Everything I say today is stuff I've learned over time. Yeah. None of it was instinctive at all. The idea that I shouldn't hold on to stuff, that kind of came to me, you know, over time as well. The idea is that, okay, look, if I have a particular version of a story, it's fine. It can exist on my hard drive, or I can print it out and I can look at it and it's nice and pretty and it's exactly what I want it to be. But when you're writing fiction that is to be sold to other people, in other words, fiction that someone is going to pay money for, then the emphasis is on making your story understandable to the person to the best of your ability. In other words, people are not going to just – you have to justify the time that someone is going to spend on your story. You have to. So if that's the case, then you have to make it friendly to the reader. Not, you know, try to remove things that make it less friendly to the reader, less understandable. And that's not to say you make it simple or you infantilize the reader. It's to say that there are things that divert the attention from what the attention should be on in a narrative. And it is your responsibility as a storyteller to remove those things. So they're just obstacles. They're not useful. You like them there because they're pretty and you know what they mean. But it's not, you know, being pretty is not enough. You know, yeah. You know, it isn't, it's not gonna work if it's just pretty writing but empty. you know, as the saying goes, it's sound and fury that signifies nothing. You know, yeah. It's not.
That's fascinating you should say it. I think it's an incredible piece of advice. And I saw you retweet something from Elliot de Boddard this morning, and she was talking about how conflict isn't always the driver in a narrative story. But, you know, you can have those wonderful moments between characters, which, strictly speaking, might feel indulgent because they're not pushing the story forward. But if they earn their place in terms of character, then I think they're worth keeping. And it's a difficult judgment call to make, isn't it? You know, because we're particularly, I mean, if you have, like for me, I come from screenwriting. And so everything, every scene has to earn its place. And the feedback you get, particularly from directors and producers, is conflict and action. You know, is the character, does the character have agency? Are they pushing things forward? But then you do have yes. those moments, which are, you know, character moments, which I think are just as important, that might not necessarily be driving the story forward, but have earned their place. Do you recognize those as well?
I do. Now, I agree, you know, very much with what Elliot de Boddard said. This idea of conflict driving narrative is a very Western idea, actually. There are many different storytelling. If you ever watch anime or manga,
yes.
Right. If you read anime, the ways of telling stories in places like Japan can be very different. There can be stories that have the main fulcrum of the story, or the main point of the story can be in the middle of the story itself. And if you're not used to that, when I started reading Japanese fiction in translation, I was confused because I had been brought up on your basic Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet eating her curds and whey. Along came a spider and sat down beside her. And frightened their way. So basically, introduce the character, talk about where they are, you know, the environment. In other words, do the world building. So here's Miss Muffet. She's sitting here. She's eating this. That's the status quo. Then comes a spider. She's scared. She gets up and she runs away. That's the conflict. You know, so.
That is the best analysis of that I've ever heard. Thank you.
You know, so we're brought up on these kind of stories with this three-act structure that basically permeates a lot of Western storytelling. But it doesn't have to be like that. And rather than conflict driving every story, what I believe is that there has to be a narrative gradient. I mean, that's what I call it. There needs to be some kind of gradient. And when I say gradient, what I mean is there is something driving the reader to want to know what's happening next. Conflict is one of the shortcuts to that, to making the reader want to say, okay, what happened, then what happened, then what happened. But as long as you can build a hunger for the knowledge of what happens next, then you have a narrative gradient. Mm. That does not have to be in conflict. It could be two people literally just sitting around talking about something, and the conversation, even though it's not a conflictual conversation, one person in the conversation has knowledge that the other does not have. And the way the narrative has been built up to that point makes the reader curious to know that knowledge. Of course, the person who has less knowledge is a stand-in for the reader at that point of the conversation, except that their reaction could prompt even more of a narrative gradient. Because if the scene is done well enough, the person's reaction should change the view of the information being given as well. And so the two of them don't have to be in conflict. They just have to have something to convey.
Yeah.
That is interesting to the reader.
Yeah.
And that what is of interest does not have to be conflict. And they don't have to change the status quo.
Yeah. I mean, that rings so true because I'd seen Japanese films in my teens, particularly the Kurosawa movies. I was big fans of them, you know, Seven Samurai, Yojimbo. But they were very much in that kind of Western monomyth form of storytelling, which is why they all became Westerns essentially as well. But for me, the big eye-opener, I remember watching Spirited Away for the first time and not knowing that, because, you know, if you're writing, you watch a Hollywood movie, you watch a Marvel movie, and within 10 minutes you figure, okay, I have an idea how this is going to pan out. Spirited Away, I was like, I have no idea what's happening next, but I am totally hooked. Same with Princess Mononoke and all of those films. And but you are still on the hook. It doesn't stick with that kind of that Joseph Campbell model, but it still keeps you on the hook. And so many scenes scenes in those films are two people in a room talking, essentially, and there'll be elements of culture in there, but there's always a lesson to be learned. But yeah, I haven't studied them properly, but I will watch them again and again and again.
Yeah, and it doesn't need to follow the format that you're used to for you to be engrossed in it. I mean, it's something like Evangelion, right?
Yeah.
Evangelion is, I'm not going to lie to you, I don't understand Evangelion, but I couldn't stop watching it. You know, what I can tell you is that it's a meditation on depression. You think you're going to get, okay, I've got, look, hey, yippee, giant robots fighting, yay, mecha suits and everything. But no, you know, one of the people in the mecha suits just refused to get up, just says, no, I'm not going today. I just can't do it. You know, the person is having regular feelings that you know, if a person reading that, you know, has ever seen anyone depressed who can't go to work, it's exactly like that. So it doesn't actually matter that your job is to get into a giant robot and go and fight with monsters. The guy's like, no, I'm not going to go fight because I'm depressed. I don't care.
Yeah.
Look, the whole city's going to die if you don't. I don't care. I'm not getting up. You know, it's like that. You know, it's like that. So Evangelion is, you know, it's about, there are many, many themes in it. But if you tell me, can you tell me the story of, you know, Evangelion, you know, the end of Evangelion, any, I could say, well, there are these giant robots and there's Eve, there's Adam, there are these creatures cloned from the first humans at some point. There's some good action. There are government agents who come and wipe the facility clean. But I can't tell you what happened in Evangelion, even though I have seen it at least three times.
Yeah, I think that goes for a lot of that anime mecha stuff. You are just along for the ride, really, aren't you? But it's always an incredible ride.
And it means something different locally than it does to the international audience, I think. Yeah. So they know what it means. You know, you watch Akira, and you know, even when you're watching Akira, that something is passing you by here. But okay, it's still beautiful to watch, and it's insane. So why not?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, you've written horror, you've written crime, you've written science fiction. Is there any pressure on you to pick one and stick with it, a particular genre? Because, I mean, Rosewater, like we say, it's being nominated for awards, it's won awards, it's getting a lot of recognition. Is there pressure now from publishers and agents to say, you know what, more Rosewater, more of this, please? Or do you feel you're able to do your own thing?
So I think that the people that I work with, my agent and, you know, and my publicist and my editors, that I think all of them know me. In other words, they know that I can't be made to do anything at all. I am extremely stubborn. The best way to deal with me is to present me with information and say, look, this is the data. This is what I think. What do you think?
Yeah.
Right. I'm not interested in writing only one thing or only one type of thing. I know people say that, okay, you should basically, you know, specialize in one thing and so on and so forth and everything, but I don't buy that. People like to be able to classify you into a particular box so that when you come up, it's a natural instinct of human beings where we evolved to do quick threat assessments on the stimuli in front of us. So if you see something, if you're able to classify it immediately, then it's not threatening to you, so it's fine. So something comes along, someone presents you with an image or a name or something, and if you can immediately classify it, then it's fine. If you cannot immediately classify it, then instinctively your mind goes to threat, you know, subconsciously, but you start to feel a little bit anxious, like, okay, well, what do we now say this is? So it is natural for us to classify things. It's a way of removing the anxiety of the unknown. But I am not... I read very, very widely. I'm interested in a number of things, and I really won't accept being put into any particular box. Someone asked me a question about what did I think about Afrofuturism, I think about 2 weeks ago, what do I think about being classified as an Afrofuturist writer? I said, I don't mind it. I don't care. It's just that it's not the only thing I am.
Yeah.
So yes, my work you can classify it as Afrofuturist, you can, but that's not all it is, and that's not all I am. So it doesn't, I understand people's need to do that, but it doesn't interest me, and you know, that kind of thing doesn't interest me. Those are conversations I already had with my agent, you know, and my publisher beforehand. It's like, look, I'm not going to be a Robert Jordan. I'm not going to give you the Wheel of Time because I'm just not interested in that. I can't stay in the same world for like 12, 13 books. It's not going to happen. Well, I should say that with a caveat, though, because I say that now, but if I get into I reserve the flexibility. I reserve the rights to go back to the world if I want to.
That is your prerogative. Absolutely.
The important thing is my prerogative. I will write whatever interests me at that particular moment. And I will not write something because I am required to do it. I think I'm lucky that I have a job that can feed me. And I'm not one of those people who wants to be published no matter what. I only want to be able to do this as long as I enjoy doing it, or as long as someone wants to buy what I'm writing, it's good. But I'm not going to keep writing different things to see what is going to sell. That's not really. I'm sorry, Alex, my agent, if they're listening. Sorry. It's not a very commercial thing to say, but I want to write because I enjoy it, and I think that if I write something I enjoy, it will show in the prose itself.
Yes,
I think if I'm just doing it, it will become turgid. If it's just me churning something out, it will become turgid, and I don't want that. I want it to be something I'm excited about.
No, so you should be. This idea of threat assessments when it comes to genre, this explains so much of the last few years. It's like Star Wars with a girl in it, run away, it's everything is falling into place now,
I mean, look, when people were ashamed of being geeks when I was growing up,
yeah,
it wasn't a thing. What is bothering people, I think, is the mainstreaming of geek culture.
Yeah.
And I think the mainstream, and by the mainstream I mean people who haven't previously been interested in science fiction or comics or whatever, or games or whatever, they're happy because they're seeing all this stuff and it's blowing their mind. And I'm happy for that. But the people who were there from the start feel like, what the hell are you guys doing in my comic shop? Why are you here? This was our space. We were happy here. And then you came along. And all of a sudden you're telling us, hang on, you're saying that, whoops, do you mean that girls were interested in all of this all along?
Mm.
No, this is a man space. This is not, it's a shock to find out certain things, because basically it means your entire worldview, which you have created and you're comfortable with, was untrue. And it takes a lot to be able to recognize that, okay, what I believed all these years wasn't correct. And what the beliefs that are relevant here are the ideas that, okay, women weren't interested in science fiction. They can write fluffy dragon stuff. They can write about unicorns, but they're not interested in science fiction. They can't write hard science fiction. Black people are not interested in science fiction. Black people don't do space exploration or anything like that. These are certain core beliefs, all right, which began, they got challenged pretty hard.
Yeah.
And if you take someone like Octavia Butler, who was the first science fiction writer to win the MacArthur Genius Grant. Okay, well, let's just call it MacArthur Grant, because I think they don't like it being called Genius Grant. But she was the first science fiction writer to win that, right?
Yeah.
That was a shock. First of all, it's a very big thing, because prior to her winning it, look, science fiction writers were considered, you're pulp writers. Nobody, I mean, people might have respect. The Le Guins of the world had respect, but they were considered to be writing pulp, and they're writing, I don't know, it's all genre stuff. It was as if people didn't recognize that there's a literary tradition in sci-fi. So when she won that, a thing that had never really happened before, then it made people realize, hang on, so this is a black woman. So all of our, everything that had gone before had told us that women and black people aren't really major parts of this. And all of a sudden you have a black woman winning this. It began to change people, but it was, again, because people find it difficult to accept change, they could simply call it an outlier.
Mm.
Like, okay, well, they'll say things like, well, it doesn't matter, even a stopped watch is right twice a day. So until, it's true, you have to have a critical mass of unusual occurrences before it is accepted as, okay, this thing happens. that happened, and you got, you know, now we're in the situation where, again, a black woman breaks the boundaries, you know, of N.K. Jemisin winning 3 consecutive Hugos.
Yeah.
All right. Boundaries being broken again by black women. These are goosebump moments for people like me.
Yeah.
You know, and still the narrative still, you know, it's still, because they think, okay, well, this is just, it's being done for political correctness. It's done being done for diversity. No, it isn't. People are writing great stories. That's why.
Yeah.
You know, can't use politics to make a thing happen in that way. That's not it. The stories are great, and you should read them. You know, some people made comments about the books without even reading the books, which astounds me, because one of the reasons it astounds me is because science fiction is supposed to be, I mean, it's science fiction, which means we're supposed to be interested in ideas and in science, which tells me, you know, observations first, then conclusions, not conclusions, then observations. But there you go. It happens.
I know. I mean, what gets me are people watching the new Star Trek series, getting upset with that. And I'm thinking, what show were you watching all these decades? This was, you know. anyway, you have a background in medicine and psychiatry, and I certainly see a lot of that in your writing and from listening to you now as well. Are these subjects you would recommend that writers study and or dip a toe into? Have they helped you in any way?
Well, yes, they have, but I wouldn't say that it is. So when it comes to writing, I hate being prescriptive, and I don't think anybody should be prescriptive, because good writers, exceptional writers, have come from every possible background that there is. I think that writing is always helped by an understanding of the human mind. I think that that understanding can either be in a formal way by studying things like psychology, psychotherapy, and psychiatry and the like, or it could be done in the other way, which is by observing people. In other words, by going out, talking to people, listening to people talk, listening to the stories of real people, reading biographies, autobiographies, histories, and the like. I think that it's sometimes a mistake, especially for professionals like me, to assume that the way to understand human beings is to study it, and that, you know, to study it academically and like, and then to understand the theories and then do observation and stuff. That's one way of doing it. But we mustn't forget that even people, you know, people like Freud, what they did is they gathered together what was already folk wisdom. They, you know, Freud didn't just, you know, come up with theories. It wasn't this sui generis thing. All right. He took theories that existed, you know, things that humanity had already encoded in our myths, which is why there's a lot of Greek mythology in the naming process of many syndromes. Many of them fit things that have been encoded into stories. These legends, these myths, they're not just stories to entertain us. They're supposed to contain certain things that pass knowledge on from generation to generation. So a lot of what is couched in scientific language was already known, you know, in folk language. There really isn't anything new under the sun. Yeah. We just like to think it is. You know, we like to think it is. So there are many ways, there are many pathways to knowing the human mind. Direct observation is probably the best. So I wouldn't say that people, you know, need to go and study psychology or anything like that. I wouldn't say that. I don't think studying such a thing is a handicap. I think it's useful. And it also helps in being able to communicate what you mean to a certain subset of people. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to writing, because characters are not going to be discussing in academic ways, they're going to be talking like human beings to other human beings and interacting with each other, it isn't necessary to understand the jargon that you need to describe it with. All that is necessary is to understand why X did Y. Why X did Y. Okay, W-H-Y, then X did something to Y.
You've discovered the flaw in audio broadcasting there.
Yes, exactly. You know, the point is never have, you know, even if you don't make it explicit on the page, never have a character do something that you don't understand the reason for.
Yeah.
Even if the character themselves has no idea why they did it, you, the writer, must know why they did it. Even if the character might think, okay, I just did this random thing. Now, they may think that, but you, the writer, you know that something happened to them when they were 15 that caused that reaction, but they're not aware of it. But you, the writer, have to know. So it makes sense to you, the writer.
Yeah.
You know, that's the consistency.
That sort of brings us back to where we came in, really, isn't it? You know that, but you don't necessarily have to put it on the page. It's the things that you leave out that, you know, can tell the story as much as the things you put in, really, isn't it?
Yes. And I actually think that the reader can tell when you know it. I don't know if it's true or not, but the reader can tell if this is paper thin. When you hear someone say, oh, the characters were paper thin, it's because they were just there in the service of the plot. X moves to Y, does this, blah, 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 blah. And there doesn't seem to be anything if you scrape the surface. There's nothing underneath. There's no reasoning for it. There's no consistency. There's no thought behind why might this person want to do this and as opposed to this other thing, you know. When someone has written something from that perspective, and you can just tell that they know more, but they're not telling it to you. Yeah. And they're leaving that for you. They're leaving that space for you to theorize, which is great.
Yeah, fantastic. I think we need to wrap it up there. What's next from you, Tardy?
I'm writing, what's going to come out soon? So after Rosewater Book 1, the next thing coming out is in March. It's coming out on the 21st of March is Rosewater Insurrection, which is a continuation of the story in the world. And after that, in July, I've got The Survival of Molly Southbourne, which is the second Molly Southbourne book. And then finally in September, the final Rosewater book, or the third Rosewater book, will come out. It's called The Rosewater Redemption.
Fantastic.
And I know what's coming out in 2020, but I can't talk about it yet. Not allowed to. But I'm currently writing a book, which is, I suppose if you classify it, it would be fantasy, I suppose. But it is more, to me, it's more of legend and mythology. Mm-hmm. So you know how you have there's urban fantasy, right? I would call this urban mythology, something like that. That's what I would call it if you ask me. Nice. And it's basically, it's focusing on, so my ancestors are Yoruba. So it's focusing on Yoruba legends specifically, which many fantasy audiences are not familiar with or used to. So it is my intention to write this. I only intend to write one book. At least that's how it is in my head. Unlike Rosewater, where I do a longer story. But in my head right now, I only intend to write one book about it. But we'll see how it goes. Fantastic. So that's what I'm writing right now.
All sounds amazing. Well, you're a very busy man. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today. And hopefully we'll speak to you again soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. Have a good day.
I love it. I absolutely love it as well. It really blew me away when he said that. It made me stop and think, actually, when I thought about our 50,000 word outline. We could have done 10 proof of concept ideas for our novel and then picked one of those to become the novel. I mean, how potentially stronger could a novel have been if it had that amount of testing against others? It's almost like it's what businesses do, isn't it? It's market testing in some ways, but you've then got the whole structure as well, so it's much easier to then write, I think, in some ways.
Just want to go back to Rosewater and its path to publication. It was originally published by Apex, which is an indie press. Can you tell us about how it came about to publication and how that led on to being published by Orbit as well?
When I finished it,
in economics, it's actually called opportunity cost. It's like whenever we make one decision, we choose that decision, but we're also choosing not to make any of the other infinite number of options we've got. I mean, it's ridiculously mind-blowing when you think about that. Otherwise, you'd be paralyzed through fear of making the wrong decision, which a lot of people are in life, interestingly.
Yeah.
They never do it because they worry.
Even for me, even when I was trying to sell it, it's very difficult to put it in a one line pitch. I couldn't pitch it in one line, per se, because if I say, okay, it's an alien invasion story, but that doesn't really do it justice, do I? And I say, okay, well, they're a telepath. Well, that's not it. Well, it's kind of cyberpunky, but that's not it either. So it's very difficult to kind of just put it and say, and I can't just, there are no books that I can combine it, that I can combine together and say, okay, it's like The Handmaid's Tale meets the Illuminatus trilogy. I can't say that.
You know, Little Miss Muffet illustrates world-building drama and conflict.
I know.
Such a great example. Such a great, but the point that he makes, that's very much Western storytelling, because this came out.
I need an agent, because it was now me trying to negotiate things that I really have no clue about. I mean, I can tell you things to look for in a contract, but that doesn't mean I know what I'm doing.
This is a very important storytelling lesson, I think. Rather than try and tell a 9-part story. Tell one story well,
yeah,
and then build on that story.
Oh, yeah. It's all about
that's
the build.
That's what happened.
Yeah.
Here are some clips from this week's deep dive episode of the Bestseller Experiment for Patreon subscribers.
Hello and welcome to the Bestseller Experiment, a special deep dive episode that we record exclusively for our wonderful Patreon supporters. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Tina Dietz. Tina is an award-winning and internationally acclaimed speaker, audiobook publisher, podcast producer, and content marketing expert. And what Tina doesn't know about audiobooks and podcasts, frankly, isn't worth knowing. Tina, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm good, Mark. Thanks. Thanks for that great introduction.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, look, let's crash straight in because we got all sorts of questions from our listeners.
If you're doing this on your own, there's about 13 steps that you're going to go through. And so breaking that out into broad strokes, you've got, first of all, you need to do the planning up front. You need to make sure that you've got your timeline laid out, that you have an idea of what is going to be your bits in the process as you go through. And you're going to need to know certain, you know, things to look for. And I'm assuming at this point we're talking about working with a professional narrator. We actually put all of this into a download into a book, though, all the steps in detail. So if anyone wants that, you can always grab a copy of that for free on my site.
Wonderful. We'll put a link in the show notes to that. And I've got a copy in front of me here, and it covers all the bases, folks. You're definitely going to want to read through that. Our book, Back to Reality, has a female protagonist. So it's important to us, we think, to have a female narrator. Would you say that's important?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. The industry standard was very strange for a long time, and it's changed a great deal since audiobooks went more out into indie publishing and into the court of public opinion, so to speak. Right. It used to be that regardless of who the protagonist was and the gender of the protagonist, that if it was a male author, you had a male narrator. It was the weirdest thing. It was the weirdest thing. And it used to be also that nonfiction audiobooks were almost never narrated by anyone but the author.
You can help support the podcast. Subscribe today at bestsellerexperiment.com/support. That's bestsellerexperiment.com/support. Thanks again.
So if you missed the full interview with Tade, you missed out on some incredible stuff. Mark and I have talked in depth. We just went from Little Miss Muffet to the Avengers in about 10 minutes and some incredible storytelling lessons. So do sign up to Patreon now. It's an absolute humdinger. You don't want to miss it. So Mark, let's talk about what's been crazy on social media this week.
Well, first thing to announce really is we had our One Page Punch-Ups episode last week. And the amazing thing with that is that Juliet Ewers, who our editor on that, she wanted to read the whole novel by Andy Kumbo Floyd. She was so impressed with that page. So that's happening.
Wow.
So, you know, one of our One Page Punch-Up submitters is now getting their book read by a major publisher. Okay. If you want to get involved, go over to Patreon. Now, one thing that came out of that is we had for this round of One Page Punch Ups, we had quite a few science fiction fantasy entries. I've decided to do a One Page Punch Ups science fiction and fantasy special. And for this, I've got Gollancz's Gillian Redfern and Marcus Gipps. Marcus has been on the show a couple of times before. Gillian's never been on before. Gillian was my editor for Robot Overlords. She's edited some of the biggest names in science fiction and fantasy. So you're going to have two absolutely tip-top experts there. The submissions deadline for that is Sunday the 2nd of June, midnight UK time. And get over to Patreon, become a chart topper supporter, and you can get your one page in. If it's selected, it gets read out on the show. You can say as featured on the Bestseller Experiment on your CV or your resume or whatever when you're submitting books. And you never know, you might get picked up by Gollancz. Who knows? You know, it wouldn't be the first time we've had a listener on our show get published by Gollancz.
Absolutely. I just love that. I absolutely love it. Because those are the things, you know, there's things about life that you just never know around the corner. You never know that you never know how things are actually going to pan out. But if you are willing to buy a lottery ticket or roll those dice, you are in the game. So well done to Andy for that. I'm absolutely chuffed for you, and good luck with wherever that might go. And thank you to Juliet as well for doing that for us as well. I think that's just incredible. So there's been a lot of other social media things happening as well.
You know, we've been asking for everyone to send in their Julie.
Yes.
You know, we had Angela Marsons on a few weeks ago, and she talked about how her partner Julie supports her. Sam Makuza wrote in. She says, so just finished listening to episode 190 and was going to do this on Twitter, but the character limit made it impossible. So she came on the BXP group and she said, so while my family and close friends are huge supporters of my book, they all smile and let me talk about it and tell me they can't wait to read it. My boyfriend and my parents stand out as my most supportive. My boyfriend is a huge reader and always leaves me be if I say I have to get my writing done. If I tell him I didn't get any chores done, but I got a couple of chapters done, he'll still smile and tell me at least I had a productive day. If I come up with an idea I love but don't know how to implement it, he will give me his opinion. We'll talk it out, and then usually he knows of a book or comic he read that did something similar that I could use for inspiration. My dad is a huge supporter because he always asked about my book and reminds me how much he wants to read it. I'd given him the first five chapters I edited to see what he thought, and he told me, I love this, but I would think you wrote it and it would pull me out. And then he would tell me what books it was reminding him of, and he was excited for the rest of the book. My mom is a huge supporter, but in a different way. She's supportive of my health goals and is a dietitian, so I constantly bug her on what I can be doing to be more healthy, and she keeps me going on my weight goals. I know what you're thinking, how does this make her a supporter of your writing? Well, guys, the better I take care of myself, I've noticed a huge improvement in my writing, and it's something I want to dive into, the more biological side of how to keep our creative juices going. I may do a non-fiction book in the future about connection between writers' output and their health. It's something I'm only casually looking into now. I theorize that serotonin production may be vital to writers and other creators. Sam, that's a fantastic post. I mean, she's got a team working for her there.
Absolutely.
It's like, you know, like a champion athlete or whatever. You know, they've got a team keeping on their toes.
I always say, you know, it's you know, in the music world, it's like Ed Sheeran's name on the front on the album cover, but there's a cast of thousands behind, and you know, there's Julies or there's teams of Julies, and I think that to have such incredible support, you know, don't stop at family if you don't find those people or partners that aren't supportive. There will be people out there, friends, writing group buddies, people on the BXP team, Bestseller Experiment. That's where you might find your Julie if you come and join it. So do always look for it, because you can see there she's spurred on, Sam is spurred on to write and write at her best. And I love that bit about health. I think that's so undervalued, and I'd love to read that book, Sam, if you ever write it, because I think that would be a very interesting read. The whole thing about serotonin is absolutely huge, and you're talking my language there.
Yeah, no, that's cool. Good stuff. We had a note from Liam Saville, also listening to episode 190. He said, I had to smile when Mr. Stay was talking about writing on the train and having people read over his shoulder. I too am a train writer, and I hate nothing more than having the person next to me obviously reading along as I write. It did, however, inspire a short story, which is now one of my reader magnets, in which my fictional writer, who may or may not be a serial killer, tells his unsuspecting reader a very dark and deadly tale. One of the truly great things about being a writer is you can take out revenge on anyone you don't like in the most gruesome manner imaginable, and then simply smile and walk away from your crime. That's Liam Saville, if you want to sign up to his newsletter.
I was wondering if Liam was going down the route of a story about an author on a train who had someone looking over his shoulder and read some deep dark secret, and then he had to kill him.
Exactly.
That'd be an interesting story. Excellent stuff.
We've got some deadline stuff. Now, Taj Frajin. Taj, a few weeks ago, wrote a blog post about how it's good to miss deadlines, how it's okay to miss deadlines. But he's done it. He's finished his book. My first draft is complete. Now's the time to celebrate and take a break before commencing the editing process. So congrats, Taj. That's great news for you.
Well done, Taj.
Who else we got? Here's another train journey. This is Patrick Masker. Wrote 1,800 words over the course of two 35-minute train journeys yesterday. If I could spend every day in trains, I'd have this book done in no time. Then, like I said, I used to be a train writer. It's a great motivator because you know that train's pulling into the station sooner or later. Usually, if it's Southwestern trains, it's later.
Is there something about... this is quite interesting, isn't it? Is there something about writing on the move? I mean, how many opportunities do you get to write whilst you're actually moving? I mean, I guess a plane is another option, but most places you're stationary. And I wonder if there's something about the movement that fires creativity. The in a train, the changing scenery. If you look up, you've always got something new to look at. Whereas when you're looking out your own window, it's always the same trees or view. I wonder if there's something in that, Mark. Maybe there is. I'd love. I think someone's probably never done a study on that, but I bet you there's some interesting psychological things that come out of it.
We've got some more writer success stories. We had a tweet from Zach Urlocker. He sent us a photo. He says, and they say you can't make a living as a writer. And he's got a check here for $2.40.
It starts, a journey of $10,000 starts with a single dollar, right?
Yeah.
Single
dollar. He's ahead of the game.
That's it. So you're also now in the top 5% earners of all authors out there, because the other 95 haven't got anything. So congratulations. Now just stick a few zeros on the end of that.
And let us know how you celebrate. We had this lovely mention on Instagram from Rebecca Paulinier, who said, last night's bath had no novel to be read. I'm very close to typing the end of my sixth novel and don't want to get distracted. Instead, I listen to an episode of the brilliant Bestseller Experiment podcast and enjoy wine and chocolate after a very long week. This is getting dangerously close to Alan Partridge's Deep Bath. Do you remember that on Alan Partridge? Yeah. Alan's Deep Bath. So enjoy your bath, Rebecca, and congratulations on finishing your book. We've got some of our listeners have books coming out. So J.W. Atkinson, he published a dark fantasy short story called Redwood Queen. I tell you what, the cover art for this, let me just share my screen, Mr. D. I don't know if you've seen this on social media yet, but this is something else. It's really, really good. Let me just do that and I'll move you out of the way. Can you see that?
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Isn't that cool?
That's amazing.
That is awesome. Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes, folks.
Go to bestsellerexperiment.com and look at the show notes for this episode. Click on podcasts and you'll be able to select this episode. Yeah, that is amazing.
Yeah. It's really cool. Wow. So congrats on that. I bought a copy.
Oh, I just suddenly saw the eyes just as you turned it off. I didn't see
creepy,
that at first.
Is it? they follow you around the room.
We just did a
deep dive with Rhoda Baxter and Jane Lovering on how to write romantic comedy. And what do you know? They've just published a book called How to Write Romantic Comedy. So Rhoda's been on the show a couple of times. That deep dive is hilarious because I barely get two words in.
She's saying something for you, Mark, honestly.
I know, it really is. And Julian Barr, coming any day now, is the second part of his series, Tooth and Blade. It's called Between Worlds. And these are Norse legend adventure. I've had the privilege of reading an advanced copy of Between Worlds. These are freaking brilliant. They are so good. They're like a Norse Michel Paver. They've got demons and magic and Vikings and swords, and it's just fantastic. I love them. So and Julian is he's a long time supporter of this podcast, so congratulations, Julian, and I hope it's a smash
and
hit.
Julian, if you just rewind the tape a little bit and put quote marks around Mark said, you could stick that on the back of your book, honestly. You talk about grabbing quotes, there you go. Fantastic. Well, congratulations as well. That's that is high praise indeed. Anything else to report, Mr. Stay?
No, that's it. I think we should stop. We've been talking for long enough.
It's time to get to bed for all our listeners. They need to get out of the bath. Actually, now that we know that people listen to us in the bath, we do have to put out a safety warning. Might become a prune. If we start doing these episodes, I keep going for the time that we are. That's brilliant. But, that's fantastic. Well, there's nothing more that excites me than hearing about new books that our listeners are putting out. Hearing about how the podcast has inspired them. The odd acknowledgement that we get at the beginning of books, that's something I never in a million years imagined would happen, but we're getting quite a collection now. I think
I've got another one.
Have you got another one? This is great. So thank you so much to everybody who's putting us either individually or the podcast in the actual acknowledgements of their book. That is one of the highest forms of praise or acknowledgement that someone can give, just to put anyone in the credits. So what have you got there, Mark?
This is Thomas R. Gaskin. Tom lives in Herne Bay. He lives near me.
Right.
And we've hooked up and we've, met and discussed. We have lovely conversations about writing over tea and toasted tea cakes and local cafe.
Very, very
and
English.
And he's got
you.
This epic fantasy series, which wraps up with a book called Search of the Lost. He's got some amazing artwork. Again, I'll put a link to this. And we're in the thank yous with thanks to Mark Stay, Mark DeVoe, and the Bestseller Experiment. That always warms the cockles of our hearts. So thank you so much. Thomas.
Brilliant yeah. stuff. Well, thank you so much for joining us this week. We've got some incredible, incredible interviews coming up. We know what they are, and you'll just have to wait and tune in next Monday or any time during the week when the podcast goes. If you haven't tried a deep dive, sign up to Patreon. Just give it a go. They are absolutely huge. You're going to get so much additional value. We really do go deep. It's something which we want to support the writing community with. So please support us in supporting you. We can't do this show without you. So thank you to everyone who's at Patreon already supporting us. If you want to join in the fun, join our BXP team group. It's bestsellerexperiment.com/support. And I ask you, as this podcast finishes and you hear the outro music, that is your mission, to go to that URL and sign up now. Do it now, folks, and help us get to our target of 500 patrons to help keep this show going. Mark, on social media, people can reach us all over the place now, can't they?
Yeah, come and see us on Facebook. We're Bestseller Experiment over there. On Twitter and Instagram, we are at Bestseller XP. Or just drop us a line. Go to bestsellerexperiment.com. You'll see a contact page there. Email us. Tell us your success stories, the ups and downs, these lefts and rights, ideas that you want for shows or for guests. I mean, we've got a massive backlog of guests, but ideas for deep dives. We've had a couple recently that have come out of conversations. We've got a fantastic deep dive about creative writing courses with David Bishop, who's come back on to do a second deep dive. And I recorded that today, and it's amazing. We've got a fantastic one about audio books with Tina Dietz. Just first-class experts on these topics, and we really go deep.
Everything you're afraid to ask, it's all there, folks. The dumbest questions, the best questions. Go deep with us at the deep dives. And I would also like just to say thank you to everyone who listens to this podcast. That's you right now, who can hear my voice. Thank you so much, because I think it would be pretty lonely and sad if it were just the two of us chatting. It'd be a good laugh over a hobnob and a cup of tea. But what makes this podcast work is the fact that you guys listen in, you download us every week, you stick us in your old lug holes and keep it going by sending all of your stories and encouragement. So thank you to everyone listening right now. You are the stars of this show, and we look forward to hearing your stories as you go on this incredible journey, living your dreams, or even just starting your dreams, wherever you're at. It doesn't matter. Just make sure that you write this week. Thank you very much, Mark, for being here again. Great interview, and I can't wait for next week. We'll see you soon. So goodbye from Mark 1.
And goodbye from Mark 2.
Goodbye.